Accession number 20456, reel 25.
Brigadier Wilson, reel 25. I was asking you where the planners for the exercise, the strategic studies section, got their information about the enemy and the enemy's likely behaviour.
In 1956-57, the first of the U-2 flights had started, and there was a very special section of TRAPE which dealt with intelligence from U-2, which was absolutely fascinating in those days. I mean, had anyone quite realised what marvellous stuff those things were producing? And of course one had the Galen organisation, and there was a great deal of intelligence we had. How accurate it was, how good it was, I don't know, because it was never put to the test. But certainly we knew a lot about what was going on. And I mean, you're coming on to it later on. You know, you had units like Bricksmith, you see, producing it too.
What was the NATO strategy overall going to be at that time? What was the NATO strategy going to be? Was it to be a mobile defence or an aggressive defence or a preemptive?
Well, it was in a state of total flux, you see, because at that time the atomic weapons were in good supply.
Yes.
We had a strategic air force cell in shape, who, again, very secret, but you know, again, one strategic studies section and what they were highly in touch with. And the whole question was, what is going to happen to Germany if such a war started? How can you stop the Russians unless you do use atomic weapons? See, had not enough troops on the ground to deal with them, or tanks or anything. And this was a whole business of debate, and this was what the command post exercises were about. And that was just one small part, because if you the muscle of NATO was America, and the question was, how do you get American supplies across the Atlantic? And, you know, what part of the Navy is going to play in this one?
Another question about getting them across the Atlantic. How do you get them across safely, and how long does it take you to get
them?
That's
it. The whole business. How long would reinforcements take to come in? What would they do? Where would you concentrate them? What would they do if they got there? Looking back on it now, I think we were putting up a pretty good bluff as far as the Russians were concerned, except the Russians knew that when it came to air power, they weren't in the same league, and although they were developing their submarine force again at sea, they probably might have been able to compete.
Did Montgomery draw any parallels between the situation of Europe then and the situation of Great Britain in 1939?
Oh, very much so. Oh, yes. 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 I mean, well, it wasn't like flogging a dead horse, but I mean, these exercises, the Atlantic exercises, were very, very, very much on the whole business of air and sea superiority.
Because in 1939 we'd had naval superiority, but not air superiority, as far as we understood it.
Well, I think it's a question as to whether we really we had naval superiority of a sort. It really wasn't enough. It just managed to scrape past 1940, and then when the Germans really got their U-boat program going, you know, we were being outbuilt.
Was there the idea that the American reinforcements would come in convoys that would fight their way across the Atlantic, Or was the idea that the navies, the NATO navies, should secure the Atlantic and then bring them across?
Do you know, I can't honestly answer that one.
Do you remember if there was any notion of bringing in substantial numbers of American troops by air?
Yes, that was of course considered. Mm. Yeah.
And do you remember where they were going to go, where they were going to be received?
No. You see, no one really knew what would be going on in Europe. Mm. What the effect of this exchange of atomic weapons would do.
How long did you calculate, or did the exercise assume it would take before atomic weapons would be used? What would be the length of the convention?
Well, this was one of the big things for discussion. Did you do a sort of a counter-strike before the other guys had sort of started?
A preemptive attack.
A preemptive strike. Mm. Or did you wait until he disclosed his hand? And, we'll talk about that one for hours.
What term view of that did Montgomery take?
After 30-odd years, it's so difficult to say. It'll be locked up in his papers and accounts of the exercises. I would hate to quote him on that one.
What were the ground forces supposed to do?
Forces were supposed to hold what you might call a safety zone or sort of trigger line,
yes,
beyond which people couldn't advance. Mm. There were certain areas in Europe where they reckoned they would not be able to stop the Russian army.
Do you remember
those gaps, where anti-tank defence was difficult?
Would that be places like the Fulda Gap?
That's it, Fulda. Yeah, exactly. And there was one north of Italy, a famous one.
Would that be through the Ljubljana Gap and the Po Valley?
That's it, there, yes. Ljubljana.
What were the NATO forces supposed to do? Were they supposed to conduct blocking and withdrawal actions, or were they supposed to put in counterattacks?
Well, we didn't have. I don't think we had enough to do any counterattacks. Mm. You see, these exercises had gone on ever since Monty had taken over as deputy commander.
Yes.
And you are bringing up all problems that came up. What can we do? What should we do?
What about the role of the Air Force? Was the Air Force to be used primarily for intimate, close air support, or providing
was going to be enough for close air support. Oh. It was your Air Force, particularly Royal Air Force, were basically sort of the V-bombers, people like that.
Yes.
And, of course, home defence.
Defence of Great Britain.
Yeah.
Can you remember roughly what it was expected the Russians would actually do if they launched a full-scale attack? Where they would head for, where they would regard as our centres of gravity, as it were?
I think the centre of gravity was always a breakout from East Germany. Mm. Always.
So the group of Soviet forces, Germany, would be the all key area of interest.
I mean, yes, basically they were the big bogeyman, yes.
And what were they expected to head for if they advanced and managed to maintain their advance?
I mean, the Rhine. I mean, basically they would want to get right up to the Rhine, and they would want to get into the north of Italy, that's the part of the world.
So it sounds like you were anticipating a gigantic strategic pincer with an advance.
Yes.
North and south.
Very much so. Mm.
Was it anticipated that we would be able to hold the Rhine or other major rivers for any length of time against such an onslaught?
I don't know if it was anticipated, but I think it was thought that it would be frightful if we couldn't. I don't think any of us will realise quite in those days what a sort of knife's edge we were on.
How did we in those days, or how did the SHAPE strategic cell assess the quality of the Soviet forces and the East German forces and the other Warsaw Pact forces compared to our own? Unit for unit,
well,
and man for man.
I don't know how much we really knew. I know now, with having served in Bricksmith, what information was coming back.
Yes.
But how that was evaluated, I wouldn't know. I mean, the only evaluation we get from the Poles and things were from deserters or from your military attachés. They didn't take part much in exercises in East Germany in the 1950s, I don't think. And in any case, in those days, the Russians, I think, regarded both the Polish and East German armies with a little bit of a question mark.
You mean in regard to the political reliability?
Yes. Yeah.
Did the planners, or the exercise planners in the cell, take that sort of thing into account when they were drawing up their
Well,
schemes?
I'm sure they must have done, but I mean, I wasn't a planner, you know. All one came across were the various briefings and the meetings one went to where you got the feel of what people were thinking.
And what were they thinking? Do you recollect what the overall
The capabilities of the satellite forces were not thought very highly of. Later on, the East German army became a very different beast.
You mentioned the possibility of an attack through northern Italy, which would probably entail a transit through Yugoslavia. How was Yugoslavia regarded at that time? Because it had broken away from Comic-Con and from Warsaw Pact.
Well,
refused to join Warsaw Pact.
This is the odd thing, you see. Monti had a very special relationship with Tito, and I went with him once to Yugoslavia, to Tito. And Tito was pretty confident that he had so reorganized the Yugoslav army that they would put up a pretty good, it's a pretty difficult country, that it wouldn't be all that easy for the Russians. And I think the Russians knew it. That's why they didn't, they couldn't really put too much pressure on him.
Thinking about the terrain in Yugoslavia, it seems that if you want to move roughly east-west in the northern portion, it's really not too bad because you have two broad river valleys to move along. But if you're trying to go against the grain of the country from the north to the south, you might find it rather difficult.
And of course you're up against the Serbs, who are natural bloody fighters.
What impression did you get of Tito? What personal impression did you get of him as a man and as
quite,
a politician?
I don't know quite what I was expecting to meet, but we had lunch with him, and he was an extremely highly educated, amusing guy. Not a sort of ordinary, illiterate peasant. Talk about any subject. And I was said properly educated.
Did Montgomery think that the Yugoslavs would fight if the Russians?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Did he think the Russians would be stopped or just held up for a substantial time?
I think he relied on the Yugoslavs to hold them up.
Did he think the Italians might be able to make a reasonable job of blocking the Po Valley if they got...
He was very fond of the Italians. He used to say that the Italians, properly led and trained, were very good soldiers, particularly the northerners. It was It was an incredible game of blind man's bluff, really.
Another factor which is of interest in this area is the question of what would happen in Austria and Switzerland in the event of a Soviet move westwards.
Monty had a very special relationship with Switzerland because at some stage they asked him to advise on their defences. And he did, in plain clothes.
Do you know when that happened?
Remember, Monty went to Switzerland. He was given the royal treatment, very much so. And that was because he had got himself very much involved in helping the Swiss plan their defences.
Do you know when he did that? Was it a permanent commitment? Or
well, I think
thing?
He did that when Western Union came in. I don't honestly know. Mm. It's something that is kept very quiet about. Mm.
Do you know anything about what sort of advice he gave them?
It was never recorded in his diaries. Oh. It was a very, very, very private arrangement.
Was this based on any personal connection with Swiss?
I don't know how or where it was based. It just grew up.
What about the Austrians? Was there any contact with them that you're aware of?
No contact that I know of. No.
So it makes sense for the two neutral powers to consult each other, wouldn't it?
I've been with him for, 18 months, and there was no... I can't recall any dealings with the Austrians, but that's just me.
What about the northern flank, the north of Norway and...
He used to go up there quite a lot. He travelled extensively over all Norway and that part of the world. Mm. But you see, you have the same problem. You have this thin, thin coastline stretching for hundreds of miles.
Nothing behind it.
Nothing behind it. Mm.
Did he take a serious view of the situation in North Norway and the prospects up there in the Barents Sea in that area?
Yes.
Do you have to know what he thought might happen?
So what can you do about it with limited air and limited navy?
Mm. What about the Swedes? Was there a view of them and their likely capabilities?
Again, I know nothing about any contacts with the Swedes. Mm. There weren't any when I was there.
The Swedes always maintained that they would defend their territory against all comers and that they reckoned they could...
Well, of course, they didn't in World War II, but...
Exactly. The Swiss did. Or
and, of course, you see, I am told that when we talk about football fans in this country, that a Swedish-Norwegian or a Norwegian-Danish football match is... like a middle-aged crusade, the blood that is shed. I mean, there's a certain amount of rivalry that still goes on. Mm. Well, the Swedes look down the Norwegians as country cousins. Norwegians think the Swedes are sort of bumped up, useless aristos, having separated from their country. And the Danes as useless anyway.
Did Montgomery think the Danes were useless or
no? No.
You mentioned that the Germans were on the scene, but they hadn't been on the scene for very long because I think it was only 1955 when it was agreed
correct.
That Germany should be rearmed. And did you get an impression of what Montgomery thought about the Bundeswehr and about the likely German performance?
I remember him talking in staff college saying it's absolutely important that the Germans were on our side, you know. They had to sort of start everything from scratch, but their cadre of officers was a very high grade lot.
Very experienced.
They'd taken great pains to select some very, very, very efficient guys. Mm. And very nice guys, too.
Were you working with the Germans day to day?
Well, no, because by the nature of my job, I didn't work closely with anyone. You know, one let them. I mean, talking about Waterloo, I'm trying to remember the senior German general's name at Shape. Was a very old family who commanded the King's German Legion. I mean, you know, the sort of ties went back quite a long way. And we had that delightful chap who was jugged after the Hitler bomb went off, who was
von Stauffenberg. Von Stauffenberg.
No. Stauffenberg's killed. I'm talking about the general.
Yes.
He's in John Brown's book.
Would that be General Beck? He was, locked
Beck
up.
Beck was killed.
Yes.
Beck shot himself. Yeah. What is his name? I know him so well.
What was he doing then in 1944,
45? He was CNC, Allied Forces Central Europe. Speidel,
yes, formerly Rommel's chief of staff, wasn't he?
Yes, the guy.
Yes.
A very, very fine guy. The chap at Shape was Kilmansegg. Kilmansegg, of course, is a great name.
General Graf von Kilmansegg.
Kilmansegg, yes. He was like a
Do you remember the Germans taking any sort of distinctive views of what sort of strategy should be adopted?
No, not initially, because you see, they'd come in as new boys, as it were.
Were they settling in gently?
They were settling in gently.
What about this question of using tactical nuclear weapons? Did they take a view of that?
Well, of course, they were very worried about, you know, after all, it was their country that was going to take the brunt of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And did they actively oppose the use of tactical nuclear weapons as a strategic measure?
I can't honestly say. We had a German eventually on the strategic studies section. I mean, I was dealing with day-to-day staff work.
Yes.
Rather than the minutiae of planning. Though, obviously, one talked to the planners, one, you know, saw the exercises, one read the briefs and so on. But I never indulged in any discussions with the senior Germans about them.
How did Montgomery get on with the Americans and with General Rorschach in particular?
Very well. Can I just, spend a penny?
You were saying that Montgomery got on very well with Rorschach.
Yes.
He had a reputation for being rather critical of the Americans.
Yes.
Why was it that he was on such good terms with Rorschach?
Well, because he didn't agree with the American system.
Yes.
Which required the staff to submit volumes of paper for the general, you know. And at the end of it, you know, it's recommended that the general says yes or something.
Yes.
And he said that this was a... they wasted their time in writing reams of stuff that they need never have, you know, put on paper. Yeah. And I think he was true. I think the American staff work can get very verbose. And it also can get... It's got a sort of language all of its own.
I mean, did you come across cases where the language was a real obstacle to mutual understanding?
Almost every day. I mean, it used to drive the field marshal up the wall. And he said, why can't they write plain English, you know? If they could use a word of three syllables, or one of one would do, you know, they will do so. It's a, how can I put it? It's a legacy of the American language. And also the training that they do at their staff colleges, starting at West Point.
Now, the other ally, of course, you mentioned was the French. How did you get on with them?
Very well. But of course, in those days, the French were looking over their shoulder at Algeria in a big way. And you had to be very careful as to what you said, because you weren't too sure sometimes which side. They hadn't really recovered from the terrible divisions of World War II.
They'd also lost Southeast Asia, hadn't they? They'd lost Indochina.
Ah, yes.
54, they had withdrawn.
Indeed. And you see, the one thing they didn't want to lose was Algeria, which was part of France, Algeria's department. Mm. It wasn't a separate country. And they couldn't, this was how they'd been brought up. Mm. I mean, if you can compare the goings on in Northern Ireland nowadays to the goings on in Algeria in the 1950s, 60s, you're not far off.
What view of it did the Field Marshal take? Did he ever express a view of the prospects in Algeria?
No, he was very careful not to take a view about that, because so many of his chums in the French army had either fought for de Gaulle or, you know, joined after we invaded Algeria. And Juin, for example, was very much on the Algerian side. Chaul was another. It was a very much divided army. You see, the one service that had nothing to do with it all was the navy, La Royale, you know. on the one hand, admired the Royal Navy, but didn't like them. But they were splendid. French Navy was out of this world, I thought.
Was the question of expanding the NATO area coming up at that time? Because the French, at one stage, had a policy of trying to persuade NATO that it should regard its legitimate sphere of jurisdiction to extending into Algeria and indeed into the North African littoral as a whole.
Yes, it was. Sort of. It hadn't come to what it's come to today. Mm. I think we were much too busy looking after ourselves to really think of expanding.
Yeah. Were the French generally in accord with the overall NATO strategy for defending Western Europe, as far as you remember that time?
I can't remember any great disagreements about that, except, of course, de Latt, who anything Monty wanted to do, de Latt would automatically say no.
Was that a purely matter of personality, do you think?
It was purely a matter of personality. Mm. They were both very stubborn characters in their own ways.
Was there one partner in the alliance that had a predominant effect on the...
Oh, yes, America. Mm. Certainly. Mm. Well, after all, she produced most of the striking power, most of the Air Force, and most of the infrastructure. Mm. Well, if it wasn't to induce it, it was repairing it. Because, I mean, by the 1950s, the European railway system was about back to normal.
You also mentioned the Turks and Greeks not getting on terribly well. Now, they'd only recently joined the alliance. They both came in 55, didn't they?
Yes.
What sort of things were they arguing about?
Oh, places like Cyprus and, you know,
sort of territorial.
Territorial. Mm. Totally territorial. Mm. And the fact that, after all, they couldn't quite forget that they'd murdered each other, you know, within the last 50 years.
Well, the French and Germans have been fighting each other also fairly frequently.
Yes. But I don't think there'd been quite the sort of exchange of territory and population. I think you look at the Balkan area, where the Turkish Empire had once held sway. It was a little bit different from the European side, where, I don't know, it was a different feeling. And, of course, basically the Europeans talk the same sort of language. Turks and Greeks don't.